In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about art and artists and the role of the government in promoting artists and what they do. Very specifically, we'll be looking at an agency that in recent years has been the focus of a lot of controversy. That is the National Endowment for the Arts that was created back in 1965. Given the kind of controversy surrounding this agency that we've seen in the last dozen or so years, one wonders how it is it came to have been created at all. We'll look at the atmosphere at that time, talk a little bit about how the NEA has changed over time, and take up generally this question of government support for the arts. And our guest for the program is Michael Brenson. He's a writer, a lecturer, art historian. He's former New York Times art critic and currently is associate professor in the curatorial studies program at Bard College. He's authored a book that looks at the history of the NEA. It's titled Visionaries and Outcasts, The NEA, Congress, and the Place of the Visual Artist in America. It's published by the New Press and is out fairly recently, just came out at the beginning of February. And he's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we do that, certainly your comments are welcome. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so we can accommodate as many different folks as possible and keep things moving along. But anyone's welcome to call and join the conversation. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number to call. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. You match the numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Brenson, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks for talking with us today.
I'm glad to.
Just to begin, as I said, you know, if you think about the kind of controversy that we've seen about artists and government funding in about the last dozen years, you might well ask, how is it that the National Endowment for the Arts ever came to be? Let's perhaps go back to 1965 and talk about how it is that the NEA was created.
Well, I think it was a very different time. Obviously, it was the middle of the Cold War, and the '60s was a particular turbulent decade. And I think that this was a country, a government that felt that art and artists could have a particular purpose or a particular use for the nation. So I can mention a couple of ideas, a couple of reasons. I think there was an idea of the artist as a very much of a heroic outsider, a kind of great figure, you know, like Titian or Poussin, or someone who could make great art that was useful for the nation, that sort of stood for the nation. And I think we were very much, this was very much a time when the country was concerned about its materialism, concerned about where we were going in terms of science, because it was the middle of the arms race and the space race too, and concerned about the effects of popular culture, all things that concerns that I think we've largely lost. And had a sense that we needed to hold our ground, to find a moral ground, to keep our center, and artists were useful that way, because there was an image of an artist that really was outside of money and materialism, and that was not connected with popular culture, that was more connected with high culture. And then I think if you throw in the idea of civilization that this country after World War II wanted to be a great civilization, wanted to be able to compete with the Soviet Union, which was not considered a civilization, but also take our place finally among the great nations of the past as a civilization, that artists had a role, that art had a role. And I think all this contributed to the momentum and the necessity that brought the NEA into being, and that really gave the NEA a kind of faith in individual artists, which seems almost inconceivable now.
Hmm. I think you mentioned that this was indeed the time of the Cold War, and there also seems to be a dimension, something of a political dimension to this. People believed that promoting arts and free expression gave us an opportunity to say, here in the United States, in the free world, in capitalist society, we believe in free expression, and of course the Soviet Union, those guys, they don't. So it was another way of drawing a comparison between the two countries and the two systems in a way that we could say, see, we're better than those guys.
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning that, because that was certainly a factor, that that free expression was something that could be used as a Cold War tool, almost. I mean, it's not that we didn't believe in it, because we do believe in it in this country, but in very complicated ways. But by throwing it out there, by supporting it, and by holding it up to the rest of the world, we could also make an argument about the superiority of our own culture. And therefore, I think there was a willingness to support free expression, to allow artists to go wherever they wanted to go, that was much stronger than it was in 1989, when we had won the Cold War and we really didn't feel that we needed to prove ourselves anymore to the Soviet Union or to the rest of the world. So I think that the free expression issue is a very important one.
Mm. The other thing, and you touched on it, another thing you touched on it, that I also think is really interesting and I think a significant contrast between then and now, is this idea that at the time people saw progress. We were making a lot of progress in technology, in science. And at the same time, people in government said we should also be making progress in the arts. And they had this idea that if the government was not involved as a funder, that there would be some other sources, but not very many. And I think it's interesting to see people making this equivalence between progress in technology and progress in the arts, and them saying, well, we have progress in this one area, but we really, in terms of culture, our cultural life, we should be making progress in that area too.
Yeah, I think I think it's partly the looking for some kind of parallel between the two, but I think it also reflects the kind of suspicion about science, and that we were putting billions of dollars into science at the time, and we really weren't sure where we were going to go with that. And it was such a minuscule amount of money that was being put into the arts, and definitely a feeling that there needed to be some kind of balance, partly because they believed in it, but also partly out of fear. And then it does raise this question of civilization once again, that all great countries in the past and the present had really supported art, the visual arts. That's the way we saw it, and we hadn't, and we had to. So if we really were a great nation, then we had to also support the visual arts to a much greater degree than we had before.
Mm. You know, having said all that, though, it's also striking that when you look at the attitudes that a lot of people had toward artists then and now, now we see people saying that artists, basically, they're, well, to use one of the words in the title of the book, they're outcasts.
Mm-hmm.
They're troublemakers. They're provocateurs. They're people who do things that really disturb us. And sometimes we wonder whether they're doing that just for their own gratification, or that there is some greater benefit. You know, all of the sorts of things that people say about artists. In fact, in 1965, they were saying all that and worse.
It's true, but I think that was also a strength, and I think there's this need to bring them inside to some degree, to use their creativity. But there's also this great speech that Kennedy gave in 1963, shortly before he died, where he talked about this outcast quality of it. It became a strength, and it became a sign at its best of a certain kind of incorruptibility, and a certain, you know, belief that artists could tell the truth, because they weren't completely implicated in the various systems that we were so sure about as a nation. So I think it's a complicated story. I think there's always a double side of it. On the one hand, a country that was really afraid of artists, and yet at a certain point where artists could have a use, then precisely what it was that made the country afraid of them became a strength and a sign of a kind of centeredness and truthfulness that we as a country really needed.
The guy who ended up signing the thing into law was Lyndon Johnson, but it really was John Kennedy that was the force, I think, behind the creation of the NEA. Would it have happened had it not been, do you think, for Kennedy?
I think Kennedy, I mean, there were sort of growing, there was a kind of momentum building up because Eisenhower in his own way too indicated at various points that the arts were really important to America as a whole. And then Kennedy and that administration and that connection with France and Camelot and kind of jumped in and took it to a whole different point and probably also realized that the country could use it in a different way. So I don't think it would have happened without Kennedy. And one of the questions that I would ask is, you know, would it have happened if he wasn't assassinated? Because this thing was building, but I think that the sense of a country in crisis, you know, of a country that needed some kind of center, some kind of moral ground, which is what the arts was becoming increasingly identified with, it just got clarified and underlined by his death. And so would he, I don't know enough about the politics at the time to know whether Kennedy would have been able to push it through himself, but I'm not sure that that's the case. I think that maybe it took that kind of tragedy to push it to the next step that really allowed it to happen.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus, and we have some callers we'll talk with. Michael Brenson is an art historian. He's been an art critic for the New York Times. Currently, he's associate professor in the curatorial studies program at Bard College. And if you're interested in reading his book about the NEA, it's titled Visionaries and Outcasts, and it's published by the New Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll start in here with a caller in Taylorville, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I would like to preface my remarks with a little bit of characterization of the culture as I see it, and it's I would say very much in the manic depressive downhill phase presently. I'd further say that it, America, past and present, but more so perhaps present, makes me think of something of one creature, a mean-spirited, barbaric, adolescent halfwit. I recall reading somewhere that Mississippi got its first art gallery in 1935. Hurrah for civilization. Robert Hughes pointed out in his nice little book, Culture of Complaint, that, here it is. Democracy's task in the field of art is to make the world safe for elitism. Like sport, art is an area in which elitism can display itself at a negligible cost and social harm. Speaking of the differentials between sport and art, America seems to take sport a great deal more seriously. And just ask the people at the NEA, or ask any civilized human being, say Western European, where they spend much more per capita on education and on their arts and public media. Dozens times more on average, I would say. I think until we have something like a grassroots movement to really agitate for some sort of a level playing field, for example, for the public media and for the arts. I mean, something like the sorts of agitations that went on back at the time of the Vietnam trauma. We're just going to continue going in this direction. Look what we've got in the White House, for Christ's sake.
All right, let's get a comment from our guest.
Well, I guess what I would say, it's really kind of an indirect answer to that. The part of the NEA that I really focused most strongly on was the Visual Artist Fellowship Program. It was the program that gave money to individual artists, and you know, in this country, artists always tend to take the hit. So I spent a lot of time just clarifying what that program was and how it worked, and the amazing number of first-rate artists that were helped by it at different times, and just the integrity with which that program worked, and the integrity with which it was essentially run by the peer panel process, which consisted primarily of artists. So I guess what I'm saying is I'd like us to regain part of our history that I think what the NEA did at its best was amazing. Mm-hmm. That I think that there's a history there of support for individual artists that the country as a whole should be proud of, and that the way artists behaved themselves, the way they conducted themselves within the agency administratively, is on the whole admirable. So I'd like us to hold that in mind, and in how we think of what did happen, and also how we think of maybe reimagining some kind of support for artists within the government in the future.
Well, one of the things that you explain in your book is looking at the way in which grants were given. A very significant change came in 1995, and it was actually something that people in Congress had wanted to do before but weren't able to do, and that is that originally the idea was, in this program that you're talking about, grants were given to individual artists, and right. The big change in 1995 was that Congress eliminated funding for individuals in addition to cutting the NEA budget by 40%. So they had much less money to give out, and they could not give it to individual artists. When you look at now where things stand, and then you compare that with what the people who created it and administered it in the first years back in the late 60s, so when you make that comparison, does the NEA, is it now doing what is it any more doing what it was created to do?
Well, first, I just want to go back and make another point about the fellowship program, because and it wasn't just fellowships to visual artists, it's to musicians, to dancers, to choreographers, that these grants were direct and unrestricted, which is basically saying, you know, here's this money, we trust you, do what you want with it, you don't have to answer to it. So there was an extraordinary faith and belief in artists at the time that I don't know if there is anything comparable in other countries, but at any rate, it really was a remarkable, it was an investment in artists, and to some degree through artists, it was an investment in the future, because it was saying that we believe not only in what you've done, but what you will do and what you will provide for us. So that the fellowship programs were really the heart of the agency. And when Congress eliminated fellowships, except for writers, in 1995, they knew that they would cut the heart out of the agency, and they essentially have. So the NEA still exists. It still has remarkable and remarkably committed people who work there, and it still gives grants to all sorts of necessary organizations and necessary causes, but its ability to affect the visual arts and affect American culture as a whole is, I think, severely limited. And as long as it will not be allowed to give money to individual artists, I think that's always going to be the case.
Let's take another caller. This is Chicago, line one. Hello.
Thank you. I'm reminded of the question that was asked of some people that visited the South Sea Islands and asked of the people, where or what is your art? And they answered, life is our art. Well, when the conditions of life were so depressed in this country that we developed the work WPA projects.
Mm-hmm.
And it resulted in the writers' groups and the mural artists and other people who were helpful in uplifting the general circumstances which people live in, and can certainly contributed greatly to enhancement of appreciation of life. But in many countries of the world where artists and intellectuals certainly became outcasts as a result of their possibly being considered deviating from the normal political line and consequently suffering imprisonment or extermination, we may have some kind of censorship going on in this country as to what they think art is or should be. So consequently, everyone has such different standards of appreciation. Of course, recently the most famous critic was Mayor Giuliani about the exhibit in the museum in New York and other things, The Misanthrope and others. Then you have, on the one hand, we've got artists who are being painted handsomely as a result of the advertisements and media that pervades through the television and so on, getting huge outlays that are helpful in some ways, but conditioning society to the point where everything looks the same. And you go to one Holiday Inn, you know you've been almost any city, it's all the same. Same thing with what we're eating, what we're thinking, what we're smoking, wearing, dressing, and purveying down to the elements that, well, I could go on and on along that line, but you know what I'm saying, and I thank you very much for your work.
I think it's important to keep in mind with the NEA that, one of the criticisms of it, or one of the assumptions about it, is that its funding was really monolithic, that it tended to fund a particular kind of art and not others. In fact, just doing the research on the fellowship program, there's a remarkable diversity of art that was funded across the country. And within the agency itself, it wasn't just objects that were funded, like paintings and sculptures and photographs, but art that was much more directly related to various communities, much more directly related to the everyday culture, whether this is community-based art or various kinds of public art or whatever. But there was a real commitment to making art available and to integrating it within the fabric of the country as a whole, where I think the NEA didn't do a very good job is that, I think that there was a kind of disconnect. I think the downside of this direct and restricted funding was that it on some level, it did allow artists to remain off on their own. And even when a lot of them wanted to give back, and both to the agency and also to be able to communicate to the communities they lived in the country as a whole, what they were doing and to engage people in general, it was very hard to do that, so that there was this kind of disconnect. But I also believe, and here I agree with Jane Alexander too, that that the agency never did that good a job of actually saying what it did and how much its funding affected so many aspects of American cultural life in big cities and small towns across the country.
Hmm. And I guess one of the things that they had to struggle against was the public perception that artists could take care of themselves based upon the fact that a very small number of them were able to make a lot of money from their work.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's important when you go back to 65, so it was in the early 60s when this happened, just to remember how few artists were actually supporting themselves, actually made a living with their art. There were very few, and a lot of artists were really struggling, and there was still an assumption then, by and large, that if you're an artist, that you couldn't make a living making art, and so that it needed a kind of support system that really didn't exist, and a kind of infrastructure. And one of the great things that the NEA did, and I think this is lasting, was to help build an infrastructure for the arts, visual arts, dance, music, pretty much across the board. And even now, when art has become something of an industry, and it's more professionalized, and there's certainly more artists who can earn decent livings, the vast majority of them don't. And, I'm around young artists all the time. I've taught in the MFA program I'd borrowed the last 2 years. It's still not the way they think. You know, they still, it's not a priority for them, you know, where they're going to, you know, how they're going to make a living, where they're going to make a living, and they don't expect much of it. And in relation to what that the previous caller said, I do think that, I mean, I believe that what artists do is important and necessary, and I do think that there's a kind of independence of thinking that goes with what artists do at their best, and it's precisely that in relation to the uniformity that the previous caller mentioned, the fact that now everything has become part of this corporate entertainment mass media network, where it seems as if there are no gaps and there are no spaces in it where anything can happen or anything that can be questioned. Artists have such a, you know, they do that. That's what they do. And it's one of the reasons why, to me, it's so imperative that they are supported.
We are a little past the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Michael Brenson. He's an art historian. He's been an art critic for the New York Times. He currently teaches at Bard College and is the author of the book, Visionaries and Outcasts. The subtitle is The NEA, Congress and the Place of the Visual Artist in America. It's published by the New Press. We have a caller we'll get right to. Others are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller next to line number two in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, good morning. The funding, how artists get funding and the effect of that funding on the kind of work they produce is a huge conundrum, which we could spend many hours going into. But what I was calling about, and it may be outside of your scope, with the NEA, but it does go directly to the issue of the Cold War and art. As I seem to recall reading that the CIA supported abstract expressionism and other abstract work during the Cold War by, among other things, sponsoring exhibitions around the world. You know, and sort of holding this up as a counter to Soviet social realism, and also that they sort of looked at the abstract work maybe as not being politically threatening to capitalism. And I just wonder if you have anything to speak to that about.
There's undoubtedly truth in that, and I think there are lessons in practical politics to be learned now, and I think the government doesn't get interested in this kind of support unless it believes it can use it. And I think that there can be a tendency, and I would include myself in this, to, if you really believe in the cause, and you, such as believing in art, which I do, to overlook the fact that it wouldn't happen unless there was some kind of unless there were various national needs that this kind of support would solve or satisfy. And I think it's important to always now, to in the future, to keep those needs in mind and be very realistic about them. But that knowledge of the CIA involvement in some of these exhibitions, abstract expressionist exhibitions during the 50s, I'm aware of that. I've never been, you know, that upset with it. Per se, I think it's kind of natural that it happened. There were good parts of it, and I think by and large, artists, even if they knew about it, would have been glad to be part of it, because I think there was a belief in what they were doing, and certainly a belief in this country and the kind of fight that was being fought. So I don't see that issue of CIA support as being inherently compromising. But I do think that those of us now have to be aware of it and have to be, you know, able to think a little bit better in terms of in practical terms.
Well, I'm just wondering if there was any impetus there on the part of insiders to help promote the, the creation of the NEA, saying, well, you know, we can get this out of our budget and put it into another budget. Or whatever other motives, and I don't know if you went into that in your research about.
Well, I think one of the important points that you suggest there is that by the time the NEA was was founded in 1965, that there was a history of government belief that art could be used, and that it could be used in the national interest. And there were all these CIA projects that started in the late 40s and then ran through the 50s and 60s. And I think if you take those out and eliminate them, that they're a part of the ground for the existence of the NEA would disappear.
Well, it's a very interesting program. It's a huge subject we could go on and on about. Thanks.
Okay,
thanks
for the call. Well, I suppose that there be some people who'd be prepared to argue that government should not be involved in funding the arts and that it should be the province exclusively of individuals, foundations, private funding. How much money is there like that that is available to artists?
Well, first of all, I do think it's important to actually know what the government did and what government funding did, and part of what I tried to show in my book is how much government funding affected individual artists, the profound positive effect it had on artists for a long time. And these are artists that are, you know, now a lot of them household names, are really important to the art world, and not just in this country, but abroad, not just the art world too, but the whole culture. And then I think that something is really lost when public funding disappears. I see the situation now, and I see the situation where the market becomes everything, and artists are pretty much forced to think, more and more of them, when they come out of school, whether it's art school or college or wherever their training is, that they have to get involved in the gallery system, in the market system immediately, and there's something about the process that gets short-circuited. It's immediately a product thinking, and it's not a process thinking, so that those 3, 4, 5, 6 years that the NEA made available intentionally between training as an artist and the professional career as an artist, where artists could explore their ideas, could go with materials that they wouldn't normally think of investigating, could read what they felt that they had to read without feeling that it needed to be turned into a product immediately. That's really essential to allow that process to develop in a way that is not immediately consumer and product oriented. And the final response to your question, talking about foundations and what they do, there is a foundation in New York City called Creative Capital, which started about 2 years ago, that's based on the investment capital model of it gives money to individual artists, not many, but it's just beginning, and sort of, you know, works with them then to connect, to think about various audiences, and there is an idea that if some of them really strike it rich, that a percentage of the money will go back to the foundation. And I know that some major foundations like Ford have been thinking for a while of programs that would pick up support for the individual artists where the NEA left off, but nothing can do what the NEA did, because the NEA, it was the country, you know, it was the country that believed in artists, and you know, it was the nation saying to artists that we believe in you, that we think you're important. So the sort of, you know, the psychological, emotional impact of that can't be equaled by individual foundations, but foundations can do a great deal, and I think that's where the funding is now going to have to come from, and I hope more and more of them do jump in where the NEA left off.
We have other callers. We have somebody on a car phone, so we'll get to them first in Monticello, line 3.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Apologize for my croaky voice, but I wanted to raise an issue which I think is often left undiscussed in discussing the federal support of the arts, and that is this, that research science, I'm a physicist, is supported by the federal government. And the first thing that needs to be noted is that, as James Gunn said, who was president of the Science Fiction Writers of America, when asked why 95% of science fiction was garbage, said that 95% of everything is garbage. And that applies to scientific research as well as artistic work. And the distortions and the problems that people have with the funding of the arts is really no different than the problems we have with federal funding of the sciences. It distorts the field. People tend to do those things which they think will be funded. And I really want to just point out, and I would like your comment on the feature, that it's very problematic to have federal funding of everything, not just in a negative way, but in a positive way as well. You talked about people doing artistic work and having to aim it towards getting funds from the private industry. In science, we worry the same thing, but in the opposite way. We're afraid that doing things to satisfy industry will distort what we would do if we were funded by the government. And I just think that people who separate out federal funding of artwork from federal funding of scientific research are missing the larger issue of what do you want funded by the government and what do you want funded by industry. And the answers may be different for art and for science, but they need to be addressed both at the same time. And I'd like your comment on that, please.
I do think you raise a lot of interesting points. I do think there was something great about the NEA for a long time, in that it really did turn people loose. It was it funded creativity. It's sort of a belief in creativity in itself, and that creativity was necessary for the country. And I think if I were to develop my own model for the future, it would be based around this idea of creativity. I think I think people need to be able to fail. There needs to be an acknowledgement in any kind of funding system that that some of it is not going to work, and that's okay. That there is a kind of experimental creative process that you're setting in motion that you believe in, and ultimately in the end it's going to pan out because of all the good thinking and matching that's going to come out of it. I think caller's response made me think about the difference in the way we think about science and art, and I guess that cuts to the core of the question for me, because we know how important science is and how crucial it is to this country's success on every level, and we've never been sure about the arts and what role they play and what they really mean. And I find myself right now almost on ground level again. I think those of us who are committed to the visual arts need to start from scratch and try to communicate why this is something that really matters, and why artists matter, and because I don't think we understand it. And I think you get a film like Pollock, which just reinforces a certain notion of the artist that basically died, 30, 40 years ago, of this kind of romantic freak who makes great work but can't be trusted, and is unpredictable and kind of immoral. And there's such a different notion of the artist out there, and artists themselves are so conscious of a completely different relation to American society. And anyway, I just think there's a whole ground there that needs to be built up again in order for something even to begin to imagine that another kind of fellowship program could happen.
Well, I'm looking here at a particular line in the book that I think is really nice, where you talk about the conditions that were in place when the NEA was created. And you write, NEA was created because the government, increasingly drawn to the romantic modernist image of the artist as truth-telling visionary outsider, decided artists could also serve the country by helping it to get beyond the deceptions, uncertainties, injustices of the moment and experience a poetic lucidity and mission that could help inspire and deliver its people. And it seems to me that that image of the artist is problematic and it may not be accurate, but in a time when people are really concerned with cultural conformity, maybe this something of this image of the artist might have appeal again.
Well, I don't think that artist that image has completely disappeared. But I think that this idea of independent thinking, questioning, taking nothing for granted—you know, the kind of things that scientists, good scientists, do in their laboratories, and artists do that in relation to their work. They do it in relation to the whole culture. I think it is part of what artists have to offer and will always have to offer. But I think that you know, we're a time that's a little bit afraid of that right now, and I think seems to really need it. I think so many people feel that we really need it. That it has become a kind of monoculture in a way, and artists, there's so many artists who can offer it and who really know how to think about a great many things and think in a very concrete way, where all the ideas are embedded in thoughts and feelings that we live with all the time. So I think that aspect of it is still there, but very few artists would accept that complete outcast, you know, that bohemian outcast notion that artists live with for a long time, to some degree with good reason, but they don't want that, you know. They don't want to be stigmatized that way. As much as I can generalize, and I feel somewhat safe generalizing here, that they're much more integrated within the culture as a whole, but there still is this commitment to thinking, sort of feeling, imagining in a way that not a lot of other people do. And as you say, I think it will always be important, and God knows it's important now.
About 7 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest, Michael Brenson. He teaches at Bard College. He's the author of the book Visionaries and Outcasts that looks at the history of the National Endowment for the Arts. We have a couple of other callers here. We'll get next to line one in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, I don't have any problem uniting science and art because, for example, science likes to make us, or science makes scientists look at what they've neglected or haven't wanted to look at, and thereby destroys self-delusions, and so does art does very much the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't seem like a difficult thing to come to say one is just as important as the other. But anyway, there was this great op-ed piece in the Washington Post last year by Robert Clark Young, where he attacked the American Family Association, who had attacked him for a book he wrote called One of the Guys, where it described in it sex shows performed by underage girls for the entertainment of sailors and Marines. And he said, this is really something, this American Family Association is attacking me for this piece of fiction, which was just satire and based on his actual experience in the Navy. When U.S. Navy ships routinely anchor off sex resorts in Thailand, and they, when Thailand is the home of 80,000 child prostitutes, and the sailors, you know, go and visit the child prostitutes, and despite it being a federal crime to travel overseas to engage in any sexual act with a person under 18 years of age, the American Family Association and our entire government doesn't say a thing about that, whereas they attacked this poor guy on his one piece of fiction, apparently was in part funded by the NEA. And I was wondering if you knew about that that whole brouhaha, and if anything had and if it had managed to shake up people at in any quarter after Robert Young pointed out the hypocrisy of it all?
You know, I haven't heard about it, and I'm glad to know about it. I think, considering this, the new administration, and considering the role of Lynn Cheney is probably going to have in cultural policy, and the importance of John Ashcroft and his views about the NEA, and his ties to the Christian right, and you know, the appeal to the Christian right. I don't think in the next, I would be very surprised in the next 4 years if anything of real cultural imagination were to come out of the government. And it still gets me back to the main issue here, which is for myself and a lot of people, which is the need to lay a new ground and to talk about you know, what, why artists matter, why free thinking matters, why free thinking, sort of creating, imagining, matters, why we need artists, and kind of build it up. I think one of the real faults of the NEA chairwomen over the years was that they never did that, that they never really were able to create, articulate, disseminate cultural policy that would indicate, so that there was some kind of ground, so that when this situation arose, or Mapplethorpe and Serrano arose, there was something to embed it into, some kind of intellectual construct that would allow a conversation to take place and not be pulled just everywhere that it had to go. So I just see it as, again, at a kind of ground level point where we've got we people who really care about the arts like I do, and I know a lot of your listeners, have to create a new ground in order to allow another kind of conversation.
I want to try and get one more here. This is Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I'm calling as an artist who applied many years for an NEA grant, individual artist grant, back in the 70s and 80s, and even into the 90s. And my impression after dealing with the NEA for many years was that it was very much an old boy network. And I even went so far in the early 70s, or actually late 70s and early 80s, to do some research, which really showed me that the people who were getting the individual artist grants were students of people on panels and students of friends of people on panels. And there was a very high sort of round robin, old boy correlation in who got the individual artist grants.
I'm sorry to have to cut any of you because we only have about a minute, but I really want to get a response here to your question, Mr. Benson.
There were 4,000 artists who were given grants over the 28-year history, and really an incredible breadth, incredible diversity. Where I think your caller, there's some legitimacy, is that it was a fellowship program. The peer panel process did evolve, and at the beginning, it was chosen by a handful of people, and you know, maybe the handful sort of it grew a little bit in the course of the early 70s and beyond that, and then it became, I think, a really great fellowship program in the late 70s and 80s, and remained so all the way through. But there were kinks in the system, and reason for some criticism. But those kinks were worked out. And I think if you take the 4,000 artists as a whole, you've got an absolutely remarkable diversity of creative possibilities in there.
I'm sorry, I can't give the caller a chance or follow-up because we've simply used our time and we're going to have to go. We want to say, though, Mr. Brenson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Our guest, Michael Brenson, his book, if you'd like to read it, is titled Visionaries and Outcasts, the NEA, Congress, and the Place of the Visual Artist in America. It's published by The New Press.